Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, we'll look at the life and work of David Foster Wallace, the writer who took his life on September the 12th. His novel, Infinite Jest, was for some the signature novel of their generation, Generation X, that is. But most of his writing career involved writing short stories. And, of course, Infinite Jest was an infinite novel. It was a very, very long, very, very, very long novel. We'll meet British writer Chris Cleave, who's not afraid to tackle large themes in his novels. His book, The Other Hand, covers refugees, globalisation, political violence and individual ethics. And we'll review David Foster Wallace's contemporary, Rick Moody's latest book, Omega Force, a collection of three stories. And we'll top it off with our continuing first-person reading of Elizabeth Winehouse's Dirt Cheap, Life at the Wrong End of the Job Market. ...36-year-old literary critic and book reviewer Geordie Williamson wrote in last weekend's Australian newspaper about the work of the late David Foster Wallace and described his novel Infinite Jest as the book of his generation. In obituaries, David Foster Wallace, who was 46, has been compared to Thomas Pynchon, James Joyce and Lawrence Stern. His contemporaries include Dave Eggers, Geoffrey Eugenides and Rick Moody. Foster's first novel, published in 1986, was The Broom of the System, and his latest collection of essays was Consider the Lobster. And his last book was published in June, it's non-fiction, called McCain's Promise, aboard the Straight Talk Express with John McCain and a whole bunch of actual reporters thinking about hope. It's an essay he, I think, wrote in 2000, but it was republished again as a standalone in June. He's also written on rap music and on tennis player Roger Federer. That gives you some idea of the sweep of his interest. Geordie Williamson joins us now from Sydney. Welcome to The Book Show again, Geordie.
Morning, Ramona.
You usually review for us, and now you're having an actual conversation. Tell
Absolutely.
Us first about your relationship with this novel, Infinite Jest.
Well, I guess like the rest of the generation who came of reading age in the late 80s and early 90s, I found myself, sort of doing a Bachelor of Arts, and I worked in a bookshop. And one of my colleagues in that bookshop pressed this enormous novel, against my chest and said, "You must read this." And I actually held off for many years
because it was so big.
It was so daunting. It is fair to say that it is not a book which resolves itself in any strong sense. It is a little like Moby Dick. There is a search for the whale, but it's also like Moby Dick in that the point's not really the search for the whale at the same time. So it was something I had to settle into. I read his short stories. I read his many brilliant essays and adored him on the sprint, but only later went for the marathon.
And when you went for the marathon, what did you gain from it?
I think that what I did is I took up a challenge. And this is not just a challenge for our generation, but anybody who lives in late modern, first world televisual culture. It is that Foster Wallace said, "Here is a 1,000-page book." And it struck me as a little bit like Wagner's operas. Here was high art in the sense that the middle class was expected to experience a bit of pain for its pleasure. Television, Foster Wallace reckoned, gave us just pleasure and we didn't have to work for it. So what he was asking us to do, and many critics complaining that it was too long, missed the point, was the length was part of our submission to the tougher strictures of proper art in that old 19th century sense. Even though it's very modern, its concerns are utterly contemporary, it was old-fashioned in that way. And I responded to that even if it hurt.
So when you say its concerns were contemporary, he was talking about television, sport, the entertainment culture, his own kind of messy life as well.
Well, exactly. there is a sense in which this book is also his spiritual autobiography. To understand Foster Wallace and the subjects that he attacks in Infinite Jest, and which Girl with Curious Hair, the short story collection which precedes it, and Oblivion, the short story section selection, and Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, which also come after Infinite Jest, these are all leading up to and leading away from this big book. And in it, we deal with tennis and we deal with television. We deal with addiction to drugs. And all of these things have been central concerns at various points in Foster Wallace's life. He was a brilliant young man. He also smoked a lot of pot. And at certain stages in his life, he was involved with rehabilitation programs. And he became very cognizant of the way in which entertainment slides into addiction. And he began drawing connections between addiction and entertainment. Tennis is also very important because as a young man growing up in the Midwest, he was a tennis prodigy. He was in the top 20 players in his section of the US youth sort of league. And so in Infinite Jest, the narrative is divided between a rehab clinic and a tennis academy. And although they seem very unlikely bedfellows, they're actually intimately connected.
And intimately connected with his own life. I'm going to ask you, Jordy, to just move back a little bit from the microphone.
Sure.
Because you're making a bit of a pop noise. I wanted to say that watching him on interviews, I've watched a lot of them on YouTube last night, one gets the sense of a young man with lots in his head. I mean, some of them are from 96, so he was younger then. Lots in his head, lots to say, making all kinds of connections with things he's read and things he's seen in a kind of breathless way. A kind of, you know, flight of ideas, I suppose you'd say clinically, or some stream of consciousness. Would you say that this is reflected in his writing style?
Well, it is in a sense, but we must beware. When he talks, he really does strike as a kind of, you know, a general, undifferentiated brilliance that's just sort of settled into this single body and just starts talking. And I think if you're talking about the Charlie Rose interview, that's just an hour of him being brilliant. The stories and the novels are very carefully structured. He agonized in a way that, you know, all great writers do about making what seems just a general kind of mass of information, of making it structured somehow. But to be fair, there is something about him that is general and undefined. He's not a writer in the sense that, say, Flaubert was a writer. The New Yorker critic, James Wood, always has a go at Foster Wallace for not being sort of controlled enough, for not dipping his writings in aesthetic caramel. But the fact was that he came from a background that was both, he studied English literature at college and he studied philosophy. And his philosophy was far more to the logical and mathematical end of that particular discipline. And he actually did two college theses. His first novel and the other one was on Aristotle and truth. In a sense, he was just a genius who settled on creative writing uneasily. And I think that you probably, you know, saw a little bit of that in watching him talk.
As I said, he's been compared to Pynchon and Joyce. Why them?
Well, in a sense, there is that very much the Joycean stream of consciousness is at work in his work. In Infinite Jest, there is that mirror of the elder and the younger. The elder being less educated but more humane, the younger being smarter and a little sort of sillier in other ways, which of course is a mirror of that great central relationship in Ulysses. I think that his antecedents are the metafictionists of the 60s and 70s. I'm thinking of John Barth, of Thomas Pynchon, of John Gaddis. And from them, he inherited a very sort of high culture clever, austere, modernist impulse. And those guys wrote books which are virtually impenetrable, very rewarding, but not for everybody. He's different to them, however, in that there is a very old-fashioned moral earnestness at work in Foster Wallace's, you know, sort of in amongst that postmodern trickery, there is real human sense and feeling. He allowed emotions to come front and centre.
But it is a funny combination of irony and earnestness, isn't it?
Well, it's at the very heart of his work, and the problem was he never managed to resolve it. He wrote brilliant books, which critics would basically say, look, I can see that this is enormously clever, and it's satisfying for the clever reader to be able to pick up on it. But to return to James Woods again, when he was talking about Oblivion, the last collection of short stories that Foster Wallace produced, he felt that what was Intelligence had so bolted shut all the doors, all the ways in to his stories, that there was nowhere really for the reader to go. I'm not sure that that's necessarily correct, but I think what is fair to say is that in Infinite Jest, he allows himself to open up and to deal with human problems, perhaps because of the autobiographical nature of the concerns there, in a way that feels more, it's more permeable. The reader can sort of get in and identify. And the character of Don Gately, who is one of the central figures of Infinite Jest, is a very moving individual.
You, of course, you know, he wrote a lot of things after that, and not returning to the novel, though.
I think he sort of resiled from his ambitions. I think that, you know, we talk about irony and earnestness. He sort of felt, I can't find a way out of my own conundrum. For cultural critics, prior to the 1950s, what you did is you got up on your pulpit and you said, the modern world is terrible. And we have a tradition of that, sort of T.S. Eliot down through George Steiner saying, the problem with the world is everyone listening to their Walkmans and that kind of thing. What Foster Wallace did that was very different is that he wrote about what he saw as the difficulties for contemporary culture from within the culture. So he spoke in the idiolect of youth culture or drug culture. He used the same postmodern trickery. He used the world of television because that was the world in front of his eyes. And yet at the same time, he was trying to make the same points about what he saw as the pernicious influence of, say, television. But, you know, obviously it's very difficult to do that. But he was born after 1950. He was the first major American writer to actually inhabit a world that was entirely saturated by television. So in a way, he was admitting that there was no way out for the writer except to address, you know, the elephant in the corner of the room.
So finally, though, Geordie, in your article you say his suicide was an extreme act of literary criticism. But, look, he had been struggling with depression for many years. His father has said that he was off his medication. I mean, aren't we just seeing the tragedy of someone with mental illness?
Absolutely. And I think we are. And I think it's you know, entirely unfair to draw your own aesthetic conclusions from someone else's tragedy. He was a man who was deeply unhappy. He was no longer responding to medication, and I think that there was just no way out for him. And certainly when you look back at his work, there are many indications that he fought against that depression throughout his life, and you can see it coming out. Mm. You suddenly read his body of work very differently in the light of his death. But at the same time, I think modern American life didn't, you know, certainly contributed to a sense that it wasn't worth going on. The world around him did feed into that depression.
Well, Geordie, thank you so much for having a conversation on The Book Show.
My pleasure, Ramona.
Geordie Williamson is a reviewer for The Australian Review of Books, and you can hear him on The Book Show too. We'll put information about the writings of David Foster Wallace on our website. That's abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. And Geordie's piece about David Foster Wallace is in The Weekend Australian. I'm Ramona Koval. This is ABC Radio National. You can't dance to current affairs, says British writer Chris Cleave, and it's this belief that inspires him to write, to populate the events that clutter the daily news with an emotional landscape. Chris Cleave is not afraid to tackle large themes in his novels. His first book, Incendiary, was about a woman grieving the loss of her husband and son killed in a fictional terrorist attack in England. Its official publication date was July the 7th, 2005, the day more than 50 people were killed by terrorist bombings in and around London. His new novel, The Other Hand, is another ambitious and complex book dealing with big issues like refugees, globalisation, political violence and individual ethics. He's speaking here with the book show producer Kate Piercy, and he begins by reading a scene early in his novel.
Excuse me for learning your language properly. I am here to tell you a real story. I didn't come to talk to you about the bright African colours. I'm a born-again citizen of the developing world, and I will prove to you that the colour of my life is grey. And if it should be that I secretly love fried plantain, then that must stay between us, and I implore you to tell no one, okay? The morning they let us out of the detention centre, they gave us all our possessions. I held mine in a see-through plastic bag, a Collins Gem pocket English dictionary, one pair of grey socks, one pair of grey briefs, and one United Kingdom driver's licence that was not mine, and one water-stained business card that was not mine either. If you want to know, these things belonged to a white man called Andrew O'Rourke. I met him on a beach. This small plastic bag is what I was holding in my hand when the detention officer told me to go and stand in the queue for the telephone. The first girl in the queue, she was tall, and she was pretty. Her thing was beauty, not talking. I wondered which of us had made the better choice to survive. This girl, she had plucked her eyebrows out, and then she had drawn them back on again with a pencil. This is what she had done to save her life. She was wearing a purple dress, an A-line dress, with pink stars and moons in the pattern. She had a nice pink scarf wrapped around her hair, and purple flip-flops on her feet. I was thinking she must have been locked up a very long time in our detention centre, because one has to go through a very great number of the charity boxes, you will understand, to put together an outfit that is truly an ensemble. On the girl's brown legs there were many small white scars. I was thinking, do those scars cover the whole of you, like the stars and the moons on your dress? I thought that would be pretty too. And I ask you right here, please, to agree with me that a scar is never ugly. That's what the scar makers want us to think, but you and I, we must make an agreement to defy them. We must see all scars as beauty, okay? This will be our secret. Because take it from me, a scar does not form on the dying. A scar means I survived. In a few breaths' time, I will speak some sad words to you, but you must hear them the same way that we've agreed to see scars now. Sad words are just another beauty. A sad story means this storyteller is alive. The next thing you know, something fine will happen to her, something marvellous, and then she will turn around and smile.
That's Little B speaking there, the character of the Nigerian girl we meet at the outset of the book, and the other half of the book is written from Sarah's point of view, a middle-class British woman with a young son and a dead husband. The book raises some questions about who's entitled to tell whose story.
I treat the idea of telling a story very seriously because, especially when you're talking about people who don't have much in the world, you know, often their stories are their greatest possession. It's what they have, it's who they are. So you have to tread really carefully when you think, you know, do I have the right to tell this story that belongs to someone else? I think when you're talking about an issue like immigration, where two cultures meet, the only way you can tell a balanced and an interesting story about that is to look at both sides of the story. So in this case, the voice of a Nigerian refugee and the voice of the English woman who ends up befriending her. I think you have to have both of those voices and both of those stories and weave them together into the narrative of what happens when those cultures come together. And I think wherever you start from as a writer, you know, whatever your background is, you're going to have to make one imaginative leap to talk about the other side of that story. And I think what's important when you do that apart from acknowledging that you can only start from where you're starting from, is also to acknowledge that you have a real duty to get it right, to do your research properly, and to treat the theme respectfully, and also to check, you know, constantly to check your narrative, people who have lived through things like that, and to say, you know, does this work for you? Is this right? Is this authentic? And I think if you do that in good conscience, with the good spirit of telling a story that's balanced and emotionally true, then yeah, I think we all have the right to tell each other stories. And I'd go further than that as well. I'd say that I think it's really important that we do. You know, I think it's really important that we consciously put ourselves in each other's shoes, because that is a way that, you know, that's the best way to see ourselves and our own place in the world as well.
That sounds a bit like a journalist talking, the idea of balance.
Yeah, good question. It's a very research-based novel. I guess I was really interested in telling the story of refugees, and the more I discovered about it, the more I discovered that these people have very, very difficult lives, and that it was a subject I needed to find out, you know, a lot more about in order to write properly. And so I guess I spent a year researching the issue, talking with these people, reading their stories as well, wanting to get it just right, because I think that if you're going to write fiction that feels really free and dynamic and where each page really makes you want to read the next page, you don't want to load it down with data, but you do want to know what you're talking about so that you can give the reader an experience of a world that they might not otherwise have seen. So for me, that's the job. I'm writing fictional stories. You know, these stories didn't actually happen, but they're based in a world that's absolutely true and plausible.
You're very successful at writing about important global political issues in a way that's emotionally engaging but also funny.
I really try to find the funny side of these situations wherever I can, because what I'm trying to do is to write an entertaining and engaging story about stuff that's real. You know, I don't see why reality has to be serious all the time. And I think a lot of the survivors of atrocity would agree, you know, the way they have survived and the way they've kept their morale together is to have a sense of humour, because it's, you know, it's being able to laugh about things that gives us our human dignity. So I consciously try to let my characters see the funny side of the situations they're in. And that's the way that I've learned to think about my life as well.
It's not everybody's response, though, to find humour. How much work is involved for you in writing the funny bits in the book?
Oh, the funny bits just come naturally. I mean, I have to tone them down a bit. And what I do, I mean, my writing style tends towards comedy, and I have to rein it in. One of the writing jobs that I do that's most fun is writing a column about my kids in the Guardian newspaper. And I think, you know, that's my natural writing style.
But for someone whose natural writing style, you might not necessarily think, oh, I'll take on issues like terrorism and asylum seeking.
Well, I've always felt that these are the big things that are happening in the world. And I don't just want to say, well, OK, here's my small little area of writing, which is going to be, you know, domestic and small scale and humorous. I'd like to take that way of seeing the world into these big issues and say, well, look, you know, that they are big issues, they're serious issues and they're political issues, but who are the people caught up in them? Well, actually, they're human beings. They're ordinary people, you know, like you and me, who are put suddenly into extraordinary situations. And they're not going to know how to react, and they are going to do stuff that's slightly crazy and odd. You know, people don't behave, you know, rationally or like robots. And so I realise that I can take this way that I see people and see life and actually just put these people in slightly bigger and slightly more testing situations. And I find that the effect is quite interesting, because you see always these questions of like, well, you know, what would I do in this situation? What would I do if I was caught up in terrorism, or if I was caught up in, you know, in an atrocity that led to someone becoming a refugee? You know, what would I do as an ordinary person? And that's what I always try to bring it back to. I'd say, well, actually, the people who are caught up in these big world issues, you know, they're not superheroes. They're ordinary people. That's why I think that having, you know, quite a down-to-earth writing style is actually quite a good way to tackle those very serious issues.
The great hope of the book for Sarah and for Little B is the potential for stories to change lives, to change the world. Is that something you believe?
Or yeah, absolutely. I don't hold out any particular claims for my stories to change the world, but I think stories in general are exactly what changes the world. You know, stringing together a narrative around the facts that people believe, you know, that people accept. I think that's how we write our own histories, and that's how we shape, you know, our idea of the society that we want to have. As people, you know, I'll tell you a story, you'll tell me a story, eventually we'll agree on the story. And that's how I think society progresses.
Have you ever lost hope in writing's ability to, the ability of stories to change?
Oh, well, it's a constant battle, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, storytelling is what, you know, peace-loving people do, right? They get around a campfire or they engage in the political process. You know, politics is storytelling as well, saying, well, you know, this is the narrative of the society we want to have. You know, when people engage in democracy. You know, democracy is about telling stories and voting for the story you like best. And the opposite of that is violence. That's having an ideology that you need to support by bombing someone, right, or by declaring war on someone's country. And, you know, that's the opposite. So do I ever lose hope? Well, yeah. You know, hope and horror coexist in this world because we have, you know, a bunch of people who are engaged in this sort of dialogue to make the world we want it to be, and another bunch of people who are firing off ordnance the whole time. So do I lose hope? Yes, I do, daily. But do I get a lot of hope as well from seeing the way people are and the way people are very gentle with each other 99% of the time? Well, yeah, I get a lot of hope too.
There is that disparaging line in the book that you can't dance to current affairs. I think B says that. And I thought, yeah. While politics may be a narrative, it may not be a narrative you can dance to. So are some narratives more important than others? Is dancing the kind of mark of a good narrative?
You can't dance to current affairs. That's why I write. I try to make it exciting again. You know, I try to say, well, this is real life and it's exciting. You know, we're actually in it. This is our only life that we're going to get. You know, we've got to engage with it really hard and make it the world that we want. And I think, I do think that it is, at its best, you know, you can dance to politics. You know, you can, I'm speaking metaphorically here because I haven't actually ever got up and done a jig to the words of any known politician. But I guess what I'm trying to say is it can be rousing, it can be inspiring. I've been listening to the speeches of Barack Obama during, you know, this presidential election campaign in the United States, and he speaks beautifully. I mean, he speaks of a vision of the world that he has that he tries to persuade people of, and he does, you know, what a storyteller does as well, which is to try to make the real world thrilling again, try to make people engage with it, try to stop people just being bored of current affairs. You know, it's a way of saying current affairs is a way of saying everything, reality, life. You know, if you're bored of current affairs, then that's a real problem. And I do think that storytelling is about making it fun again and finding ways into the story for people, making it human, making it real.
I guess too, the title, The Other Hand, speaks to trying to balance what you were saying before, the kind of fulfillment of hope and the realization that it's not always going to happen. The Other Hand is partly about, I mean, more literally, Sarah learning to make do with one of her fingers missing, about her kind of living with compromise, making do with what's lost.
Yeah, that's right.
So did you, with that title, were you trying to get across this balance between horror and hope? Or is that too grand?
No, that's a really nice description of it. Because on the one hand, you have horror, and on the other hand, you have hope. And we have those both hands, right? And that's, I think that in most human lives of people that I've met, talked with, you know, researched or encountered, that's what people are left with. They have both. The hope and the horror coexist in our own personal stories and in the way that we see the world. And most, I don't think anyone is a glass half full person or a glass half empty person, for example. I think that, you know, some situations we see the hope in them, some situations we can only despair, and then you wake up, you know, and you have a better day. And that's what we're left with. You know, we're left with, you know, our lives being a model of those two things. And what, something that I find really beautiful about people is their ability to muddle through, you know, in this really ambiguous world that we live in, and to try to find the funny side and to get on with it. I mean, that's why I think people are beautiful and, you know, worth writing about and worth caring about.
Just to finish, Chris, there's a little video preview on YouTube where you're talking about The Other Hand, and you say that you write to make something beautiful. For yourself or for other people?
Mainly for myself, I think. If I'm really honest, I love writing because I get a real kick just out of forming the sentences and out of the craft of it. But also because, you know, it's a way of claiming the world and saying, well, this is something that's ugly, and look, there it is. I've served it up again and made it beautiful. I found a beautiful way of looking at something ugly and frightening, that means that, you know, I now have some hope for that situation, and, you know, it gives me, you know, extraordinary satisfaction to do that, and I really hope that, you know, if people read it and if they get a kick out of it too, then that's great.
Chris Cleave speaking to Kate Pearcey about his latest novel, The Other Hand, which is published by Sceptre. You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. And early in the program, we spoke about US writer David Foster Wallace. Rick Moody has shared the literary limelight with Foster Wallace alongside Dave Eggers. Rick Moody has been described as having a prodigious gift for ventriloquism. And while the list of accolades for his writing seems to trail his every word, as we'll hear, not all the critics sing his praises. His latest book, Omega Force, is a collection of three stories. Kirsten Alexander read this collection and found the literary terrain patchy.
Rick Moody is the worst writer of his generation. That's what one critic said when Moody published his book of memoirs titled The Black Veil. But anyone who's read Moody's startlingly good novel, Purple America, or his two books that have been made into feature films, The Ice Storm and Garden State, must beg to differ. I wonder what that critic will make of Rick Moody's latest offering, The Omega Force. For my money, this collection of three conjoined novels is patchy, with two accomplished but unremarkable stories, and one that is remarkably good. The critic who slammed Rick Moody so comprehensively caught him on a bad book, but he's a strong and smart writer, albeit inconsistently. The first two stories are about the characters, so if you enjoy rich and nuanced printed portraits, then these stories will sing to you. In the first story, also titled Omega Force, we enter the world of Dr. Van Dusen, a pompous and self-righteous man who's retired from his job as a government official to live in a well-to-do community on an island somewhere off the east coast of the United States. Van Dusen would like to be seen as a man of authority and taste, but comes across as overbearing and silly. He's also a recovering alcoholic, though it seems his recovery has been severely compromised when we first meet him, waking on someone's porch after a night of drunken revelry. When Van Dusen leaves the porch, he takes with him a diverting-looking paperback he sees lying on the floor and heads down to the foreshore. During his amblings around the island's exclusive golf courses, bars and beaches, Van Dusen becomes fixated on the pilfered paperback, a pulp sci-fi novel called Omega Force that fuels his wacky conspiracy theories. He comes to believe the book is not a work of second-rate fiction, but a document sent to alert him to dangerous events about to take place. He decides it's his mission to stop dark-complected people who, Omega Force tells him, plan to claim his town. Dr. Van Dusen is a larger-than-life embodiment of one version of the fear that swamped the United States after 9/11. He is as colourful and bombastic as a P.G. Woodhouse character, with delusions that, predictably, go nowhere. Fear and loneliness feature in the stories that follow too. The second story, K and K, revolves around a small mystery in an insurance company and the office manager Ellie, who tries to get to the bottom of it. Ellie is in charge of the tea room suggestion box, a responsibility she takes seriously. So when unusual and menacing letters appear, she decides to track down the author, mistakenly settling on one of her co-workers, another dark-complected individual. But she has made a terrible mistake. Ellie is a sad and lonely person, unnerved by the changes afoot in her office. But Moody writes her with little empathy, so it's hard to like her. Ellie comes across as mean and meddlesome, and we're inclined to feel some animosity towards her. And when she has her rather tragic realization about the author of the letters, it seems a bit meaningless. But perhaps the first two stories seem weak by comparison, because the last story, The Albertine Notes, is so good. It's not flawless, and it has copped some criticism, but it is a truly compelling, complex, unnerving piece of science fiction writing. This story is set in a post-catastrophe New York. A bomb has decimated an enormous chunk of the city, and the survivors have turned to a drug called Albertine in order to cope. Albertine allows them to access their deepest memories from before the city was bombed and relive them. Which might be fine, issues of addiction aside, if one's memories were uniformly happy. But of course they're not. And since memory is a messy business, the drug addicts of Moody's stories find themselves reliving moments of jealousy, fury, embarrassment, and humiliation, while hoping for their life's glory moments to come back to them. The main character in this tale, Kevin Lee, is as deluded and troubling as Van Dusen and Ellie. He's a journalist with the job of writing a feature article about the history of the drug. But he's such an unreliable source of information that by the end we don't know if he was ever really given the assignment he says, or whether he is a drug addict who imagined it. Perhaps the drug lords really are using him, or perhaps his deeply disturbing theories about how the drug came into the world are true. This story has seen Moody compared to William Gibson, Philip K. Dick, and other futurists. There have been mutterings that his idea of a post-apocalyptic world filled with drug-addled citizens has been done before. But there's surely no topic that someone hasn't covered. And the Albertine Notes is an exceptional piece of writing that more than makes up for whatever weaknesses fill the pages of the Omega Force that lead up to it.
Kirsten Alexander reviewing Rick Moody's Omega Force or Omega Force. It's published by Faber. Next on the Book Show, our regular conversation with Robert Silvers, esteemed editor of the New York Review of Books, talking about Philip Roth's latest novel. We'll discuss the sad fate of one of the Soviet Union's great scientists, Nikolai Vavilov, and we enter the fantastical world of Marco Polo's journey to discover and describe the world, no less. And Australian author John Marsden has created his own version of Hamlet, the ultimate story of revenge and betrayal, but his version is for teenagers. John Marsden's Hamlet is frustrated by sexual desire, the tyranny of the adult world, and his own brand of teen angst. He wears black jeans and t-shirts and plays footy with his mates, but it's still set in Denmark and the ghost of his father still haunts him. So that'll be on the show later on today after 10 a.m. If you want to hear this program again, go to the website. You can find today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.